content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com, that is GSUGGSinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Time Magazine edition of November 24, 2025. The cover, as usual, features a red border, a white inner border, and Time in large block capital lettering in white, except it fades to gray because part of the background of this cover photo is black. So here we have a profile of a woman, and she is in strange colors. Goodness sakes, she's got green skin and yellowish red hair and some red shadowing on her face, and her shirt, which looks like it would be a black and white print, is more of a chartreuse and evergreen. She has very dark red lips. She's wearing black framed glasses, and on her left eye there's a contraption. The caption reads, Alice Charton, Charton, 87, slowly lost her sight. A surgically implanted chip brought it back. How brain-computer interfaces will shape humanity. Seeing the Future by Jeffrey Kluger. That's what it says on the front cover, and that is the story I'm reading next, rather first. Science is the topic. Mind meld. The brain-computer interface is real. It is changing lives and could soon change the world. By Jeffrey Kluger. Photographed by Julian Pebrell for Time. And that is the photograph of the woman on the cover. It has been a long time since Alice Charton got a good look at a human face. There are plenty of people moving through her world, of course, her husband, her friends, her doctors, her neighbors. But judging just by what she can see, she would have to take it as an article of faith that any one person was there at all. It was 5 years ago that the 87-year-old retired school teacher living in a suburb of Paris first noticed her eyesight failing, with a point in the middle of her field of vision going hazy, muddy, and dim. Soon that point grew into a spot, and the spot into a blotch, until it became impossible for her to recognize people, read a book, or navigate unfamiliar places on the streets. The cause of the problem was age-related macular degeneration, AMD, a disease that afflicts some 200 million people worldwide and involves a breakdown of the cells in the retina, particularly in the area known as the macula, which is responsible for central vision. AMD does not typically cause blindness, but vision can be severely impaired. As for a cue for AMD, non-existent. I always worked with children, teaching them how to read, says Charton, so it was especially devastating for me not to be able to read. But after 3 years, but 3 years ago, everything changed. After battling 2 years of slowly deteriorating vision, Charton was able to claw back a small portion of her lost world. Today, while she still cannot see faces or walk the streets unassisted, she does read. Not very much, just an hour in the morning and an hour in the afternoon. But restoring even that small portion of her lost sight was transformative. This brought me hope, she says. It literally changed my life. The breakthrough came about thanks to the work of Science Corps, C-O-R-P, period, a four-year-old neuroscience company based in San Francisco and led by biomedical engineer Max Hodak. In an experimental procedure dubbed Prima, P-R-I-M-A, which the company has now performed on a few dozen people, surgeons working with the company implant a 2-millimeter by 2-millimeter computer chip with 400 hexagonal electrodes directly on the spot in the retina that the AMD has destroyed. Patients like Charton then put on a pair of bulky black plastic glasses equipped with a tiny camera that looks out on the world. So it's the camera that's the contraption in the front cover image. Looks out on the world and beams what it sees in an infrared impulse directly to the chip. The system uses the infrared wavelength, invisible to the naked eye, as opposed to visible light, to prevent the signals from interfering with the residual peripheral vision the subjects still have. From the chip, the signals transmitted to the optic nerve, then to the brain, restoring something resembling normal vision. The chip that works this optical magic is not much to see. Under a powerful microscope attached to a computer at the science headquarters, it resembles an oversized circuit board. To the naked eye, it is a tiny flake of nothing. But a flake of nothing that brings sight, imperfect maybe, but sight all the same, to the nearly blind. There is an eye chart that healthy people are supposed to be able to read at a distance of 4 meters. Even at 1 meter, untreated patients can barely read the biggest letters on the top line using their peripheral vision, says Hodak. In a clinical trial of Prima, patients were able to read down to the 5th line on the eye chart. That trial, just published in the New England Journal of Medicine, involved 38 patients, including Charton, recruited from across Europe, all of whom underwent the Prima procedure. Post-surgery, nearly 80% of them improved their performance on the eye chart by 20 letters, and 84% of them could read letters, numbers, and words at home. AMD patients in our clinical trial were able to read and write again, not just letter by letter, but word by word, says Daniel Palanker, professor of ophthalmology and electrical engineering at Stanford University, in a statement that accompanied the release of the journal study. Palanker conceived of the Prima system in 2004 and has recently been working closely with Hodak and the science team, serving as a part-time consultant on the Prima project. The next generation implant should have pixels that are 5 times smaller and more of them, going from about 400 in the current implant to 10,000. This should allow for visual acuity of 20/80. And with the help of the camera's zoom function, could even reach the equivalent of 20/20 resolution. Science Corps is not stopping there. The company's researchers are also developing technology that involves implanting a chip directly on the brain, which could allow people who are paralyzed by a stroke, an accident, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, to operate a computer, a smartphone, a wheelchair, even lights and appliances with their thoughts alone. For those whose condition has robbed them of speech, the chip could one day make it possible to translate thoughts into words and sentences and paragraphs on a screen. The technology could even translate those thoughts into spoken, computer-generated words in the person's own voice, if video or other recordings of them speaking before their illness were available, which the AI loaded into the computer could copy. In this system, the implanted computer chip would not just sit on the brain, but become part of the brain. Using a technology Hodak calls the biohybrid model, the chip would be seeded with stem cells, which would grow into the brain tissue, forging useful connections with neurons that govern thought, speech, creativity, and more. You can imagine making a chip with 100,000 electrodes that, when this grows into the brain, you could get a billion synapses, Hodak says. Right now, you can get information into the brain very easily. Getting information out of the brain is limited. Imagine if you could get imagery or audio or imagination or memories out of the brain. He says James Cameron's Avatar movies are a pretty good reference for how biohybrid interfaces work. Paralyzed people would not, of course, inhabit new bodies as they do in the films, but they would gain some control over their worlds as if they were up and about. Science Corps is not remotely alone in pursuing this union of the computer and the brain, this wedding of cold silicon and warm carbon. According to the World Economic Forum, there are up to 680 companies worldwide at least dabbling in brain-computer interface, BCI, technology, making for a sector valued at $1.74 billion in 2022 and expected to grow to $6.2 billion by 2030. BCI today is what the personal computer was in the early 1980s, an infant technology that could grow in globe-shaking ways, with some of the companies talking about not just treating patients with ALS or other forms of paralysis, but also using the technology with firefighters, the military, and other first responders, speeding reaction times and communication. BCI could even be used by the general public, or at least that part of the general public that wants to have mind-to-mind access to AI systems. People with brain implants will be able to interact with AI in ways that people without brain implants do not, says Matt Angle, CEO and founder of the Austin-based BCI company, Paradromics. That is, in some sense, a superpower. Leaving the text for a moment to a photograph here that shows the circuit board that Hodak uses in his Prima components. The circuit board receives signals from a brain chip. Okay, the background of this photo is black and dark blue. So what we see in the foreground are hands, two hands, presumably of Hodak, holding a little thing. I don't know how to describe it. It is about the length of this person, the person who's holding it, of that person's thumb. And then it's in green, and then it has a square shape. And within that square shape, it's kind of bluish. There are little green blobs, kind of like little snails crawling somewhere. And then within that square, there's a gold-colored square, much smaller than this person's thumbnail. Maybe the size of the little fingernail, which we don't see in the photo. It's little, though. And that is the circuit board that would receive signals from a brain chip. Okay, back to the text. The new science is causing not just a technological sensation, but also a cultural one, twanging a live wire in the popular mind. No sooner were the COVID vaccines released in 2020 than unfounded rumors swirled they contained microchips that would be injected in the body, giving the government access to your thoughts. No sooner did reports go around that the U.S. and China were installing dashboard cameras and other equipment to detect signs of fatigue in long-haul truckers, then the internet spun that up into stories about both countries using hardware that could read the drivers' minds. It is not for nothing that Apple TV's Severance, the addictively twisty thriller about Office workers who undergo microchip brain surgery to separate their work minds from their home minds earned a staggering 27 Emmy nominations at the 2025 awards. The public reaction to developments in the BCI field is all of a piece with this. Equal parts healthy fascination and troubling misinformation. Over the last 20 years, every time there was an advance in this technology, the principal investigators would get calls saying that someone, the government, their wives, had put a chip in them, says Florian Sulzbacher, the co-founder and chief science officer of Utah-based BlackRock Neurotech, a BCI company. There's a lack of training and critical thinking. BCI, for better or worse, is here. The job now is for scientists to figure out how to use it and for lay people to figure out what to make of it. The best known of the BCI companies, thanks to the ubiquitous presence and deep pockets of its founder, Elon Musk, is Neuralink. That's Neuralink, excuse me, N-E-U-R-A-L-I-N-K, based in Fremont, California. Founded in 2016, the company has so far placed its implants in the brains of 12 people, hoping to allow them to operate a computer or smartphone with their thoughts. Neuralink is currently running a clinical program dubbed Prime, which is seeking to enroll 22-year-olds and up who have quadriplegia and are willing to have a 1,024 electrode chip, about the size of a quarter, implanted for a study expected to last 6 years. In January 2024, the company implanted its first chip into the brain of Noland Arbaugh, a 29-year-old Yuma, Arizona quadriplegia patient who lost movement below the shoulders in a driving accident. The implant allows him to control a cursor on a screen with only his thoughts, playing video games, surfing the web, communicating with friends. Hodak was part of this groundbreaking work as one of Neuralink's founders and its president before leaving to launch science. Now, I'm going to abridge here. The first BCI surgery occurred in 1998 when neurologist Philip Kennedy implanted a chip in the brain of a man who suffered from locked-in syndrome caused by a brainstem stroke. After intensive practice, the patient was able to move a cursor on a screen, a significant achievement, but a painstaking one. The limitations in the results were partly the result of the limitations of the chip, which was a four-channel model that was able to carry only minimal information. It was a very primitive device, says Jamie Brannigan, a resident neurologist at Mount Sinai in New York and a BCI expert, but it was the first example of an inhuman brain-computer interface. Since then, a more powerful chip, the Utah Array, has become the default device for the BCI field. The chip measures 4 millimeters by 4 millimeters and includes 100 needle-like probes, each measuring 1.5 millimeter, which penetrate brain tissue. It was first implanted in a human being in 2004 and has been the go-to chip for most BCI work since. The Utah Array has a proven track record of safety, reliability, and longevity, says Sulzbacher. The thing about the Utah Array is that it's a 1990s device, and if you were using a 1990s chip in your smartphone, you would very quickly know about it. Hodak concedes the biohybrid model poses perils. There's always a chance the stem cells could grow uncontrollably, crowding out native cells and damaging the brain. To prevent that, the system has a kill switch in the form of an antiviral drug called ganciclovir that could be used off-label to attack the new cells and stop the growth process. For now, the work goes on slowly. Most BCI studies in the U.S. are conducted under the Food and Drug Administration's FDA investigational device exemption, which permits developers to work with animal and human subjects before a device is approved. Planning for clinical trials, running the trials, writing up the results, then waiting for permission to market the device can take 5 years. Still, most of the leaders of the BCI companies agree with the FDA's go-slow way of doing things, at least for the public record. These are Class 3 medical devices, which means a permanent implant, says Hagstrom. You really want to make sure you develop a good safety profile while the device operates over time. After that, the FDA usually requires a 12-month follow-up study. Finally, there's the inevitable matter of what all this shiny new technology will cost. The companies are not at all ready to discuss marketing so nascent a product. But Hodak does venture a number on the order of $100,000 to $200,000 for a Prima implant. Even though we would like this to be as low cost as possible, he says, the reality is this technology costs several hundred million dollars to develop and bring to market. BCI is now at a profound inflection point, a young science that's only now beginning to mature. The matters being sorted out in the lab in the field are not just technical and medical, they're existential. Humanity's developed a lot of new technologies in the past 150 years. Powered flight, automobiles, electric lights, radio, television, the telephone, motion pictures, and more. But there has always been an unbreachable barrier between them and us. The machine stood over there, and we stood over here. Computers demolished that wall. They actively engage our eyes, our hands, our ears, our minds. With BCI, they're becoming part of our physical selves. In at least small ways, the machines are becoming more human, and the humans, by definition, are becoming more machine. The benefits are real. So, too, are the questions they raise. Let's see. Under the science heading, Jeffrey Kluger wrote this article, Mind Meld. I did abridge it somewhat. Now for the milestones page, we have one major article, 2, 4, 5, 5 along the left-hand column in smaller print. I'm going to start there under the heading Died 2. Appear Maria Riva, an actor who was the only child of Hollywood star Marlene Dietrich. October 29, she was 100. Donna Jean Godshaw McKay, a singer in the rock band The Grateful Dead, November 2, at the age of 78, announced her retirement from Congress in 2027 by Nancy Pelosi, November 6. The California Democrat has served in Congress for 38 years and was the first and only female Speaker of the House. Arrested. Three of the four suspects who police believe were directly involved in the October 19 heist at the Louvre. The $100 million worth of jewelry stolen from the Paris Museum is still unaccounted for. Blocked. the Trump administration from mandating people provide proof of citizenship on federal voter registration forms by a federal judge in Washington, October 31. Apologized Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney to U.S. President Donald Trump for an anti-tariff TV ad that prompted Trump to suddenly end trade negotiations with Canada. And finally, the big article. This is nearly three columns worth of type. And there is a photo here. Died, Dick Cheney, American Regent. This is written by Carl Vick. And the photo is of Cheney. Cheney sought a strong president, but called Trump dangerous. Mr. Cheney is standing at a podium here. Most of his hair is white, and there is a very large receding hairline. He's wearing glasses, speaking into a microphone, wearing a blue-gray suit, a light blue shirt, a red tie, and standing in front of either the real thing or a reproduction, perhaps photographic, of the U.S. flag. In a half century, navigating the heights of U.S. executive power, Dick Cheney went from being widely admired as the competent public servant overseeing the U.S. victory in the first Gulf War to profoundly polarizing, albeit in ways that might now make many wistful. The divisions Cheney inveigled were grounded not in personal aggrandizement, but in differing concepts of duty to nation. His legacy at the time of his death, November 3, at 84, was as the most powerful U.S. vice president in history, who after 9/11 intrigued for the CIA to use torture, for the National Security Agency to scoop up the communications of every American, for the invasion of Iraq, which killed hundreds of thousands, shifted the balance of regional power to Iran, and ultimately expanded the terrorist threat. Cheney mined the powers of his office so effectively that in the first term of President George W. Bush, he was described as regent, the nominal subordinate who wields the real power over a boy king. His reputation for stealth and rigidity gratified conservatives, and in liberal circles sketched a caricature of villainy laid on thick in Vice, a 2015 feature film that portrayed Cheney as a henpecked bumpkin who a few scenes later has become a diabolical mastermind. No other politician in recent American history moves so swiftly from light to shadow without the accelerant of personal scandal. He would run the gauntlet of being the toast of America after Gulf War I and then being this monstrous, hideous person, this warmonger, torturer, blow up the world, his late friend, former Senator Alan Simpson, told Time in 2021. Cheney embraced the notoriety, joking in speeches about his reputation as Darth Vader, dressing his black Labrador for Halloween as the Dark Lord of the Sith. The reputation distracted from Cheney's failure as the official Bush had placed in charge of terrorism to heed warnings about 9/11. But he preferred working in the shadows, eyebrow cocked in meetings where he maintained a sphinx-like silence. In a capital where information is power, Cheney warned subordinates not to characterize his views to outsiders while manipulating the processes of a federal government he had learned from the inside out. His Secret Service code name was Angler. Cheney physically embodied both prudence and paranoia. In 2007, the Wi-Fi was disabled on his cardiac defibrillator, lest a malign actor induce a cardiac arrest in the man, a heartbeat away from the presidency. When President Trump was conniving to remain in office after losing the 2020 election, Cheney organized a letter of warning signed by all 10 living former defense secretaries. Advocacy, all the more effective, coming from a former public servant who had become synonymous with a maximalist position on presidential power. The brief time with Wikipedia co-founder Jimmy Wales on rebuilding trust online and off by Harry Booth. Jimmy Wales describes himself as a pathological optimist, and yet, when the co-founder of Wikipedia spoke with Time in October, he still seemed somewhat surprised that his online encyclopedia actually worked. Wikipedia is very trusting, in a way that always seemed a bit crazy, Wales says. If you think about the chaos of social media, Wikipedia's model of allowing anyone to edit any entry seems completely insane, he says. We're speaking because Wales just penned his first book, The Seven Rules of Trust, which tries to distill what Wikipedia and a few other bright corners of the Internet, Wales sites Airbnb, Uber, and eBay, can teach us about rebuilding trust in a world awash in skepticism. Since Wikipedia's launch in 2001, trust in politicians, mainstream media, and to some extent each other has all plummeted, Wales says, with consequences extending beyond political deadlocks. Wales, 59, was friends with Joe Cox, the British Labour Member of Parliament, who was murdered in 2016 by a far-right extremist days before the Brexit referendum. He believes the rise of politically motivated violence is a natural result of this feeling of a complete breakdown of societal norms and of the idea of trust, of being able to say, look, I disagree with you, but I trust we can have a dialogue and we'll find a compromise and we can move forward, he says. And yet Wikipedia has gone from being kind of a joke to one of the few things people trust. Lately, though, that breakdown of trust has started nipping at Wikipedia's heels. Billionaire Elon Musk, who was once a big fan of Wikipedia, has turned on the encyclopedia, as has White House AI and crypto czar David Sacks, conservative commentator Tucker Carlson, and even Wales' estranged co-founder Larry Sanger, who have all claimed Wikipedia is biased. In October, the day before Wales published his book, Musk released a Wikipedia rival called Grokopedia, which he said used his AI chatbot Grok, G-R-O-K, maybe it's Grok, I don't know, to generate entries. Currently, the AI-driven encyclopedia has more than 885,000 articles, many of which appear very similar to their Wikipedia counterparts, while Grokopedia is dwarfed by Wikipedia's more than 7 million English-language articles. Musk said in a post on his social media platform X that Grokopedia will exceed Wikipedia by several orders of magnitude in breadth, depth, and accuracy. Musk has been critical of Wikipedia for some time, calling it Wokopedia, and in 2023 offering to give the platform, which is overseen by the nonprofit Wikimedia Foundation, $1 billion if he could rename it Dickopedia. Early responses to Grokopedia have split along familiar lines. Musk fans have lauded Grokopedia for having no human bias and no errors, and for its nuance and detail in entries on topics like George Floyd's death, Brokopedia's article foregrounds Floyd's criminal record in its opening lines, mentioning his murder by a police officer only later. Critics, meanwhile, note that articles about Musk and his companies are longer than their Wikipedia counterparts, yet omit unflattering details. Unlike Wikipedia, Grokopedia cannot be directly edited by users. They can inspect the sources and submit correction suggestions, but these are not debated on public talk pages or decided by human moderators the way Wikipedia's are. They are instead processed by Grok, a version of the same AI chat box that made anti-Semitic statements after an update in July, forcing XAI to apologize and deactivate the update. Whale's response to Musk, he told Bloomberg in October, "If you feel like Wikipedia has got some bias, encourage people to come and participate. People who agree with you. Do not paint us as crazy left-wing activists or something. We are not." Wales seems keenly aware of Wikipedia's shortcomings. His book revisits infamous episodes like when an online troll used the site to falsely implicate journalist John Siegenthaler in the Kennedy assassinations. Wales writes that governments, activists, and ideologues have sought to use the platform's editing tools to push their worldview. But the site's continued growth suggests these interests have not won out over the voluntary army of Wikipedians, he says. The fact that Wikipedia is still massive, more popular than any newspaper, is partly because we try really hard, not perfect for sure, to stick to the facts and to give transparency. Wales says, you can see where the information came from. You can click on it and check. Wales himself waded into an editing conflict over the site's entry titled Gaza Genocide, November 2. Writing on a page for discussing edits that the article fails to meet our high standards for stating in Wikipedia's voice that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. He called it a particularly egregious example of the site's broader neutrality issues. Wales' comments prompted pushback from some editors. Why should the opinions of the largely impartial UN and human rights scholars be weighed equally to the obviously partisan opinions of commentators and governments, one commentator asked. Because that's what neutrality demands, Wales responded. Our job as Wikipedians is not to take sides in that debate, but to carefully and neutrally document it. The Wikimedia Foundation said in a statement that even as co-founder, Wales is just one of hundreds of thousands of editors, all striving to present information, including on contentious topics, in line with Wikipedia's policies. Grokopedia is not the only AI-driven threat to Wikipedia. Some 65% of the nonprofit's most server-straining traffic now comes from bots, some of which scrape the site to feed into chatbots for training. Instead of clicking through to Wikipedia, search engine users can now often find their answers in, sometimes wrong, AI-generated summaries. That is if they do not go straight to ChatGPT or Claude. Wales says all of this means islands of human-generated content like Wikipedia become more important than ever. He says his principles of trust are just as relevant to AI developers, because every time you get an AI answer and find out the AI hallucinated and just made that up, it reduces your trust. That is where the real world comes in. Part of Wales's pitch is that most of us already practice trust in very routine ways, such as getting into a rideshare or sharing an elevator with strangers. He points to Braver Angels, a U.S. group that hosts in-person conversations between people with opposing politics. Participants often emerge a little more understanding, a little more ready to think about compromises. Wales says, the challenge is designing institutions and online spaces that tap into those impulses. Wikipedia's collaborative culture, at its best, is a web version of that, slow, structured, and imperfect. And for internet interactions, Wales's best advice is disarmingly simple. Direct your attention toward activities that build trust. Audit your feeds. If you find yourself spending too much time using social media and being fed information that you do not trust, then stop doing that, he says. He offers one specific nudge. Delete X from your phone. From the bulletin, the previous article was written by Harry Booth. And now from the bulletin, this is written by Rebecca Schneid and Richard Hall. Fears of new genocide at Darfur, D-A-R-F-U-R, burns again. Darfur has once more become the center of a wave of violence in Sudan's brutal civil war, sparking warnings of a repeat of the genocide that blighted the region two decades ago. After a suffocating 18-month siege that had trapped tens of thousands of people and caused widespread hunger, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF, captured El Fasher October 26. The city was the last holdout in the region of the Sudanese armed forces, which has been fighting the RSF for the past 3 years. Martha Ama Akia Pobi, the Assistant Secretary General of the UN for Africa, told the Security Council October 30 that the fall of El Fasher marked a significant shift in the security dynamics of Sudan. Warning, the territorial scope of the conflict is broadening. Reports of massacres, executions and sexual violence carried out by the RSF soon followed as thousands attempted to flee the city. Graphic images of those atrocities circulated on social media as the paramilitary group, a descendant of the same Arab militias implicated in what the U.S. termed genocide in Darfur two decades ago, carried out ethnically targeted massacres. It was like a killing field, Tajal Rahman, a man in his late 50s, told the Associated Press. Bodies everywhere and people bleeding and no one to help them. One of the worst incidents took place at the Saudi hospital, the last medical facility operating in the city, where some 460 people were killed in several waves of attacks, according to the World Health Organization. The UN estimated more than 70,000 fled El Fasher in the week after it fell. But only a fraction of that number, 5,000, had arrived in the nearest city, Tawila, 37 miles away during the same period. Where are all the missing people? Michel Olivier Lacharité, head of emergencies at Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, asked, as reports of mass killings proliferated. Based on what patients tell us, the most likely, albeit frightening, answer is that they're being killed, blocked, and hunted down when trying to flee. MSF said many who made it to Tawila were severely malnourished and reported torture and sexual violence along the way. November 3, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC, declared famine in El Fasher and the town of Kadugli in South Kordofan province, which is also under siege by the RSF. Famine has been declared in five other locations in Sudan since the war began in April 2023. The IPC said 20 other areas in Kordofan and Darfur are also at risk. The brief news. Good question. Is the NFL safer than high school football? By Alana Samuels. This may be a bridge. Scientists are starting to better understand the degenerative brain disease, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, perhaps, CTE, even as more athletes say they believe they have it. What causes CTE, says Dr. Daniel Daneshavar, chief of the Division of Brain Injury Rehabilitation at Harvard Medical School, is the cumulative force that a person gets exposed to, perhaps most infamously on, say, a football field. Because CTE is caused by cumulative head impacts and not just one big blow, people who start playing football as kids, even those who may not play past high school, can end up with CTE. But while the NFL has made some changes to try and help players avoid repeated head impacts, advocates point out that the groups that operate organized football for younger players have done relatively little. Everybody in football is aware of what the NFL has done and has made an active choice not to follow, argues Chris Nowinski, the CEO and co-founder of the Concussion Legacy Foundation, who's been talking for years about the need to better protect athletes of all ages from CTE. It is just a dramatic failure of leadership. Indeed, in 2016, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell acknowledged football-related head trauma was linked to brain disease, a big step for a league that had been reluctant to admit any connection. Since then, the NFL has prohibited tackling during off-season practices and in early stages of preseason, reduced the length of overtime in the preseason and regular season, and banned players from lowering their heads to make contact with an opponent using their helmet. Perhaps most importantly, the NFL significantly changed the kickoff in the 2024 season, moving teams closer together to limit how fast players run at one another. The changes appear to be reducing concussions. Recorded concussions decreased 17% in 2024, the year the new kickoff rules went into place, compared with those in 2023. Few college, high school, or youth leagues have made similar changes to how the game's played, or even acknowledge the connection between the game and CTE. The NCAA, for example, still allows a relatively high number of live contact practices, those in which players wear full pads and practice tackling and blocking. After a few days of acclimatization in the preseason, schools are allowed to have 8 full contact practices, and they're allowed to practice tackling and blocking for as long as 75 minutes in each practice. The NCAA, which declined to comment for this story, also has not adopted the NFL's kickoff changes. High school football has done even less. In 2014, the National Federation of State High School Associations, NFHS, issued recommendations for minimizing head impact exposure and concussions in football that included limiting full contact practice to the regular season and limiting contact in practices. But the recommendations still allowed full contact practices 2 to 3 times a week for up to 90 minutes per week. Carissa Niehoff, CEO of NFHS, wrote in a 2019 blog post, "There was no link between CTE and playing high school football." She says she still believes that today, and there's no way for researchers to disentangle the possible effects of playing other sports when they study this question. Youth football may be the least regulated of all. It is easy to find TikTok videos of young kids running the Oklahoma drill or the bull in the ring drill, both of which pit two players against each other in close contact. Both lead to high incidence of injury and are not allowed at the professional level. The best strategy to protect youth, Nowinski and other experts say, is to set minimum ages for the most dangerous activities like tackling. In 2011, USA Hockey banned body checking in the 12 and under leagues, and in 2016, U.S. club soccer banned heading for players under 12. There seems to be little interest in banning tackling in football for kids under 12, though, Nowinski says. In 2023, the Concussion Legacy Foundation worked with legislators in California on a bill banning tackle football for children under 12. The bill had the support of legislators, but in January 2024, Governor Gavin Newsom, citing parents' rights, vowed he would not sign it. If California will not pass such a bill, Nowinski says, it is unlikely any other state will. That was by Alana Samuels, and I did read it in its entirety. Here's the page with eight questions. We might not hear all of them. Esther Zuckerman writes about Bess Wohl, W-O-H-L, the playwright behind Liberation, on the legacy of second-wave feminism, her mother's role in it, and the state of women's rights today. First question, feminist causes are experiencing setbacks. How much did that influence the play? Answer, I could not have anticipated how women's rights would be under assault in our current world. That only upped the urgency and affected deeply how people are receiving the play. The audience comes in ready to receive and speak up. I'm going to read all the questions to you and just choose some of the answers in this time. Liberation's been called the best play on Broadway this season. What made you write it? The structure's unique, a memory play that's not a memory because the narrator's telling her mother's story while playing both characters. How did you crack that open? When I saw the play, a woman in the audience consoled the narrator when she mentioned her mother was no longer alive. How have you experienced the audience reaction? Answer, I've observed those things too. People feel they have a stake in what's happening and permission to show up in that way. It is something I wish happened more at the theater. The fourth wall can be a sad thing because ultimately we're all here in community together at this moment. That's the point of theater. Question, the play is as explicit about your limitations as a white woman telling this story. How do you approach that? Question, at the top of the second act, the women appear nude and discuss their bodies. How did that come about? Answer, it came from my conversations with women who had been in a consciousness-raising group. I knew it would be risky. The scene where women are nude but not sexualized feels important. Women's bodies can exist in space in this way. We can be subjects, not objects, and you are going to witness it now. Question, what are some of the most surprising reactions you've heard? Answer, a lot of people leave saying they want to call their mom. Other people see their relationship with their partner in a different way. That's been huge, that this play can penetrate the walls of people's homes. This play asks a lot of political questions, but the intimacy has been the real surprise. Question, has it transformed your relationship with your own mother? Answer, thinking about my mom as a young woman is something I've been able to hold in a different way. Betsy Adem says in the play, maybe I should have showed you more of who I was. I am a mom to three daughters. Am I showing them too much? Not enough? Will they ever see me as something beyond mom? To see the full humanity of my mom has been transformational. Liberation is the play about which this author writes. It's been called the best play on Broadway this season. What made you write it? Answer, because my mom worked at Ms. I grew up steeped in the ideas of second wave feminism and women's liberation. I loved sitting on the floor of her office under a giant Wonder Woman poster while I could hear her clacking away. As I got older, I started to come into contact with those ideas in a personal way. I got married, had children, tried to have a career. All of a sudden, I started to experiment with these ideas in my own life. What was wrong? What was left out? Are these practical? So much of my life was a conversation in my head about whether or not I was going to become my mother. Having a character physically embody that struggle felt really powerful. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.